This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program. Each week, our staff puts together the Trumpet Weekly. This is a digest of the most important news from around the world. And we finished our draft of this week's issue last night, and this morning as we met to discuss what to feature in this radio program. Almost everything that we felt we needed to talk about had just happened and hadn't made it into the Trumpet Weekly. There is so much happening, we decided we need to put this story in, and oh, we forgot about this story, and so we have a lot of important items to talk about today. I have, to help me, the staff of the Philadelphia Trumpet and the Trumpet Weekly here in the studio with me. I have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK.
Hello.
I've got Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi.
And Robert Morley.
Nice to be here.
And we also have a special guest we're going to bring in a little bit later on in the show. Gentlemen, are we ready? Here we go. Our lead story today, the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly, is called Why Europe Won't Let Greece Go. Now, this is a subject that we've talked about a little bit in the past couple of weeks, but there's an angle here that I think is really important that I'd like to cover. We're going to go straight to the man himself, the author of this article, Richard Palmer, to give us the scoop of what this is about. Richard, tell us why this cover story is important.
Well, you couldn't really get more topical or more up-to-date than this story. Right now, Alexis Tsipras, the Prime Minister of Greece, is meeting with Putin, and essentially what this, and this is exactly what this article talks about. You've got Greece coming up against its deadline, about to go bust if it doesn't get the money it needs. Is it going to go and stick with Europe? Or is this going to cause Greece to shift out of Europe's influence? And is it going to go over to a nation like Russia? So in this article, we explore this. There are some strong historic ties between Russia and Greece, as we talked about on this program a couple of weeks ago. Historically, Russia has been a strong patron for those Orthodox countries that are right there within Europe, and it supported those against Central Europe. But what this article says is no. Europe is absolutely not going to allow Greece to go over to Russia. So whatever happens with Tsipras meeting with Putin right now, whatever happens over the weekend as things come to a head with this bailout agreement, Greece is not going to be allowed to leave Europe's influence.
What I find interesting about this article is there are a lot of people looking at this situation, a lot of people uncertain about what's going to happen. And obviously, there are a lot of things that we can't really know. You come down really strongly and say, you know, there are things that we can know. And to me, this really differentiates the Trumpet from every other news analyst out there. First of all, you go into some important history that demonstrates why you feel like we can be confident that in whatever happens, the details, still Greece is going to remain under Europe's control. Can you give us a bit of an idea of the history that you're focusing on?
Yes, certainly. So we, I mean, some of it's very famous history. World War I, for example, a lot of that and the build-up there was the fact that you had Serbia was aligned with Russia. So you've got that potential from history. But then you've got much more recent history as well. So back in the 1990s, Europe essentially went to war. NATO went to war. And a big reason for that was to bring the Baltic region away from the communist Yugoslavia and into this European sphere of influence. And so now even we see a lot of those nations are coming into the European Union. The ones that aren't in the European Union are very much in Europe's sphere of influence. They're on their way to joining the European Union. So they did that for Yugoslavia and for the Balkan areas. In terms of geostrategic importance, Greece is way more important than that, way bigger. It's absolutely essential. They've got tons of islands for controlling that region of the Mediterranean. It's absolutely essential for Greece projecting its power, for Europe projecting its power over into the Middle East. For millennia, Greece and Turkey have acted as gateways between Europe and the Middle East. So if they went to all that length to keep Yugoslavia and to keep the Balkans in Europe's sphere of influence, they are absolutely going to keep Greece in that position. There's no way that they're going to let Greece go.
So just looking at history, you see Europe has an intense interest in maintaining control over its southern flank, basically, and control in the Mediterranean. What is it that, you can see that historically, but you're looking at things from more than just a historical perspective. You're also looking from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, which is unique to the trumpet. What is it that is so important to Europe about that region, prophetically speaking?
Right. There's a whole load of prophecy that informs everything that we've covered from the whole start of this Euro crisis. And I think it's been quite interesting just the way, because of that prophecy, like you said, we don't know the day to day. We don't know whether Greece is going to leave the Euro this weekend. We don't know specifically whether they're going to leave the Euro at all. But some of the biggest prophecies we've been talking about at the trumpet bear directly on what is going on. So for decades, we've been talking about how Europe is going to move from being this fairly loose conglomeration of quite a few different nations to a superstate made up of 10 nations, or at least 10 regions of nations. So we know that there's going to be a radical change there. It's going to be much more united. We also know it's going to go from having 27 member states down to 10. And this could be, like I said, it could be a grouping of member states, or it could be that they're going to lose a whole bunch of members. We also know that there's a clash coming between Europe and the Middle East. And so we know that there's going to be strategic thinkers within Europe who are going to be working out along the lines of, okay, well, how do we project our power into the Middle East and into North Africa? And so we know that they're going to be looking at the importance of Greece in that situation. So there's a whole breadth of prophecy that informs exactly what's going on in this one situation.
You can look at those specific prophecies, and you can also see just the tension that is building within Europe over the exposure on its southern flank, the way that it sees a lot of threats in northern Europe, even now with terrorists, with immigration problems, those types of things. Even that, just looking at current events, you can see how for them to lose control over Greece and to, say, allow that to slip into the influence of a power that they're really not on very good terms with in a lot of cases, Russia, or it could slip out of Europe's orbit in other ways, that would really be problematic.
Absolutely. And I do think that this is an excellent example, this whole situation of where history, of where current events align exactly with the prophecy that that the trumpet and the plain truth have been teaching for decades and decades and decades. And so if you closely examine any one of those three areas, it brings you to exactly the same conclusion.
So informed by history, current events, and prophecy, give us a brief summary of what you expect to happen with Greece as it's facing this extreme economic crisis.
First of all, I do not think they're going to end up leaving the European Union. I think whatever happens when it comes to whether they stay in the Euro or not, they'll find a way to make sure Greece remains in the European Union. I think they will very much limit how far Greece is allowed to go to Russia. I think that there's probably already been conversations between leaders in Germany and leaders in Russia about Greece, and it wouldn't surprise me if they've come to some kind of arrangement. I think it would be quite likely if by the end of the day we do find that Putin is giving a little to Greece, some to Greece, but not enough to buy Greece outright, essentially. So we'll definitely see Greece remain within that sphere of influence. And I think if they do try to take any radical steps to leave that sphere of influence, then Europe will take equally radical steps to make sure they stay there.
All right. Excellent perspective. We appreciate that very much. We've started with Europe. This is the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly digest of news from around the world. And you can get this this report sent to you every week via email. Just visit thetrumpet.com. You can receive this in your email inbox every week. It's full of just packed with news. We're going to stick now with Europe. And what I'd like you to do, Richard, if you wouldn't mind, just give us the overview of important events that have happened this last week within Europe. And I'm sure most of these we're covering in this week's Trumpet Weekly.
Sure, yeah. Well, the migrant dispute, you mentioned that already. Immigration is getting bigger over in Europe. So Italy is getting absolutely overwhelmed with migrants from North Africa. You've got some cities now, and in fact, almost the whole northern region is refusing to take in any more migrants. And now that's creating tension within the European Union because Italy wants other EU nations to help them out with this problem. Those EU nations don't want to. There's France and Austria are doing things to restrict their borders with Italy. Ultimately, taking in immigrants is very unpopular, and EU nations aren't going to go there. So instead, watch for Europe now to take a more active role in the Mediterranean and a more active role into North Africa to prevent those immigrants coming over. Another big story is Europe pledged stronger ties with Latin America. We had a Latin America summit, actually that was just over a week ago. And so China has been making some big overtures to Latin America. They offered to invest $250 billion. And so Europe is, they've kind of taken Latin America for granted a bit. And I think this has given them a jolt. They're sitting up and they're making more active efforts to make sure that Latin America remains strongly related with them.
I'm sure you've got other stories, but we're running out of time on what we can spend on Europe. But you've been a busy man this week. You've got another article that you're working on that's really another big story out of Europe. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. I think this will be in a magazine under the headline, Pope Calls for New World Government. And so the Pope released an encyclical, a official addition to Catholic doctrine yesterday evening. And I think the first thing, before we even talk about what's in that document, the first thing that's really noteworthy is just how much attention this has gotten from the media. Usually the release of a papal encyclical, it's big news within the Catholic Church, but outside of that, nobody really even notices. Whereas this was a huge media event. We had bits of it leaked ahead of time. It got leaked that global warming was in there, so that meant there was a discussion about from a whole range of different outlets that don't usually talk about the Catholic Church. You had the Guardian newspaper even had a live blog on the release of the papal encyclical. So years ago, this would have been nothing when it comes to the Guardian's coverage, but they're doing a minute-by-minute update. And so just the media hype surrounding it is really fascinating. The Guardian called it the most astonishing and perhaps the most ambitious papal document of the past 100 years. So it's getting a lot of attention. Now, in terms of what's actually in the document itself, a lot of the discussion has revolved around global warming, but I don't think global warming is the big thing to take away from this. It is part of it. That's part of what he talks about. It's a wide-ranging plea to humanity on behalf of what the Pope calls our sister, Mother Earth. And so he talks about global warming. He talks about things like water pollution, about resource depletion. He warns about resource wars. But it's his solution to these problems that is most remarkable and most dramatic. And here, the Pope calls for essentially a new power to be given control over the world. So he talks about one world with a common plan. He quotes Pope Benedict talking about the urgent need of a true world political authority. So this is quite a dramatic request, really, from the Vatican. And it builds quite a lot, I think, on his encyclical that we talked a lot about last year. So that one, that encyclical talked about an overhaul of the global financial system. It was the one where he criticized unfettered capitalism. And at the time, one of our columnists, Mr. Brad McDonald, wrote about the radical nature of this document, but then he said Pope Francis has yet to present a detailed overt action plan for the global economy. And this latest encyclical is much more of that action plan now. So instead of talking about a radical overhaul of the global economy, it gets much more down to, okay, how do we do that? And so he talks about enforceable international agreements, global regulatory bodies, global regulatory norms. And so that's the big news, I think, to take away from this document.
Gentlemen, any thoughts? We have a Pope who's interested in giving more power to international bodies. And you look at the power that international bodies have today. And I mean, what are we talking about? The United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Court in The Hague. How much legitimacy do these institutions have?
Not a lot. I think if you look at what the Pope is really saying and what Pope Francis is really saying, even going beyond his attack on capitalism, which is really an attack on America's financial system as the world's leader of capitalism, I think you can read between the lines and see that he's really pushing for a system that resembles closely the system that historically operated within Europe, which is, you know, the hierarchical system with the Pope at the top. I think that's what it comes down to. He talks about this moral force to make sure that, you know, greedy capitalists don't. Well, where does that moral force come from? Well, in his view, it comes from the Catholic Church.
Well, that's exactly in line with an article Mr. Ron Fraser, one of our late columnists, wrote 6 years ago on a very similar encyclical released by Pope Benedict. And really, Pope Francis, despite the fact that he gets all of this big coverage, he doesn't say anything different than Pope Benedict said. And in that article, Mr. Fraser just made the point is if you look at this language, it's exactly the same language that the European Union uses. What he's describing is just a European Union type of power that's got control over the whole world. And he very closely makes that the resemblance between those two.
One last comment, Jeremiah.
I just think that it's really brilliant of the Pope to sort of wrap his agenda in the packaging of a global warming concern. Mm-hmm. That is something that's become, it's been touted as the biggest threat to the world by many different politicians and scientists. And so it's really significant because by saying that he wants to rescue the environment, he's able to really build a lot of clout for the Catholic Church in a way that is just perfect for this modern age in which global warming is always just decried as such a scary thing for the world.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program. We've been talking to Richard Palmer in the UK about big news out of Europe. We're going to turn our attention now to the Middle East. Brent Noctegal, can you give us some stories that caught your eye this week from the Middle East?
The stories I want to talk about, they relate to the June 30 deadline that we're facing for the nuclear deal between Iran and the world, basically. And these stories that are in the Trumpet Weekly just highlight how desperate the United States is for a deal. The first one of these is a report that came out this week that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has ordered 35 separate chlorine gas attacks on his own people since midway through March. Now, we'll remember that with Syria, President Obama's red line was the chemical attacks. And if Syria did have a chemical attack, then he would be forced to use a military action against the state. Russia came and bailed him out and said that, no, we'll take it all. And then Syria's president did agree to get rid of all his chemical weapons. Then Bashar al-Assad comes out and uses chlorine on his people, which technically aren't a chemical weapon. Well, partway through March, the United Nations Security Council, they came out and said, no, it is actually a chemical weapon, chlorine gas. And then the U.S. State Department was pressed with this question yesterday. What's the United States going to do? They're crossing the red line. And he said, well, we think a political solution is the way to go forward. So it shows that this is obviously a proxy of Iran. They're not willing to deal with him with a military dimension because that might negate the progress on a nuclear deal. Now, the second story that's in there in the Trumpet Weekly is that El Monitor, they asked the question, is the State Department skirting U.S. law on sanctions? So according to U.S. law, every 6 months, the State Department has to report to Congress whether or not, well, basically what Iran is doing as far as its military goes and its progress in nuclear weapons. Well, El Monitor brings out that they haven't reported for 3 years about what Iran has been doing, so that more sanctions obviously weren't placed on Iran when they could have been. The next story is interesting as well. You had the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who came out and conceded this week that they did make a mistake in not referencing Iran and Hezbollah when they put out their 2015 World Threat Assessment of U.S. Intelligence community. So they didn't declare them a threat back in January, and they were questioned on this, and then he comes out and says, well, probably we should have mentioned them. But again, they didn't want to put a bad stain on Iran's record because of the nuke deal. The final thing that came out this week, which was a dramatic reversal of the United States position, relates to the past actions of Iran on its possible military dimensions of its nuclear program. We talked about this last week. Secretary Kerry came out and spoke about that this week. And he said that we do not want to fixate on the things that Iran has done in the past, but rather we are looking to see if they're going to maintain their compliance in the future. Now, the United Nations came out and said that we're not going to have a deal unless we can look back into their past and see if they've abided by the UN Security Council directives. The United States came out and said this week, no, we're not going to worry about what they've done in the past. We'll only look to the future. Now, these four stories that came out this week just highlight the collapse of the United States at the negotiating table on the behest or calling for this deal.
All right. Thank you, Brent. In this week's Trumpet Weekly, we have a big story about the Middle East. We're just going to bring in the author of this article from thetrumpet.com, Anthony Chibadewe. Anthony, can you tell us about this story that you have in this week's Trumpet Weekly?
My article was based off a report from the Wall Street Journal about Iran's support of the Taliban. Now, that's not really news, because Iran has been supporting the Taliban since as far back as 2007, despite the fact that Iran and the Taliban were sworn enemies prior to that. And that's also despite the fact that Iran is Shiite and the Taliban is Sunni. And that's also despite the fact that Iran supported NATO's attack on the Taliban back in 2001. Now, what's really news is that support has recently increased in scope and in volume, and that support has increased in spite of the United States bending over backward to try to appease Iran.
Yeah, those stories that Brent was just talking about show how hard the United States is working to try to make sure that these nuclear negotiations don't go off the rails. Meanwhile, Iran is going behind its back and supporting terrorist activity, attacking U.S. forces, attacking other coalition forces in Afghanistan, really showing their true colors.
They have been supplying weapons, ammunition, and even training the Taliban. And the United States has been struggling to get out of Iran or out of Afghanistan, because Iran is sponsoring these Taliban fighters. The U.S. has been trying to get out of Afghanistan, but it has been struggling. And in fact, the drawdown of the U.S. troops from Afghanistan has made it easier for Iran to continue sponsoring the Taliban. But it's not just the United States that has been frustrated by Iran's efforts in supplying weapons to the Taliban. Germany has had more troops in Afghanistan more than any other country other than the United States and Britain. So if Iran has been supporting the Taliban to fight the Germans, it means that Iran has been indirectly fighting the Germans. And we know that from Bible prophecy, Germany is going to do something about that.
Yeah, we're watching. We've been talking a lot over the years about expecting more confrontation between Iran and Germany, and Iran provoking Germany into action. And here's a theater where it's happening almost directly. Iran sponsoring these attacks within Afghanistan, Germany trying to lock down and secure that country. And so they're really going after each other, aren't they?
It's a crazy situation. It's direct confrontation, really. It's a declaration of war, essentially.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We look forward to that, reading that in this this week's Trumpet Weekly. It's up on thetrumpet.com. You can read that by visiting that website right now. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. You can receive it in your email inbox. Just go online to thetrumpet.com and become a subscriber. Coming up next, we'll have news from Asia and America. And later on, we'll have our lightning round of important headlines from all of our panelists. We will be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3 FM from Edmond, Oklahoma. This is our week in review, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. And we're going to take a look now at Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, what were the big stories from Asia this week?
Russia and China are redrawing the world map in a way that is eerily similar to what Germany, Japan, and Italy did before World War II. That's in a powerful piece written by Victor Davis Hanson that we've included in here. And Hanson says that another historic parallel to this story is the way that the U.S. and other Western nations are dealing with this aggression. They're very reluctant to confront it. They hope that if they just sort of ignore it, appease these powers a little bit, that it'll sort of go away. Mr. Hanson says that from the look of these aggressor nations' behavior and from the reluctance of the U.S. and other powers like that, it really looks like the world could be very near to another global war. There's another story in there about India and Russia taking unprecedented steps toward working together to modernize a state-of-the-art fighter jet. And this is just the most recent in a really long list of Russo-Indian cooperation measures, especially in the realm of military. And it shows that despite Western efforts to isolate Russia over its recent aggression against Ukraine, Russia still has plenty of very powerful friends, such as India and China as well. We've got another piece in there that says, despite Japanese policymakers saying that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's drive to rearm Japan is unconstitutional, he is forging ahead. So, you know, regardless of their opposition to it, he's quickly transforming Japan into a full-fledged military power once again.
All right, the big story from Asia this week.
The big story is that the Chinese hack on the U.S. government was much worse than originally assumed. We have an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly. It's called, Has the U.S. Just Suffered a Cyber Pearl Harbor at China's Hands? Now, you may remember in the first incident that broke a couple of weeks ago, we learned that hackers had obtained the records of more than 4 million past and present government employees. But then there was another hacking incident that experts say was far more significant. And this one affected many millions more. Apparently, everyone who has ever applied for security clearance with the U.S. government. So that adds up to some 14 million people. And the hacked data includes, for every one of these 14 million people, it includes a 127-page background form with personal details such as mental health conditions, police records, drug and alcohol problems, arrests, bankruptcies, all sorts of potentially very compromising data. And that's not even the biggest part of it. The biggest part is that the form also includes sensitive information about people that these applicants knew well. So their children and all the records, you know, police records for a person's child, their spouses, their other relatives, their friends, all of that information apparently has been hacked. And so possessing this kind of data gives hackers great power over 14 million government workers, past and present.
There's a lot of people who, you know, you compared this to Pearl Harbor, but there you had warplanes shooting people down. You had people dying. Here it's easy for people to maybe underestimate just how dangerous this could be. But give us a sense of what kinds of uses this might have for the Chinese.
Well, a University of Tennessee law professor, Glenn Harlan Reynolds, he wrote a piece saying, with this sort of information, China will find it much easier to recruit agents, to blackmail decision makers, and, in the event of a straight-up conflict, to strike directly at Americans in the government, all without launching a single missile. So it seems like it's mostly in terms of coercion, threats, blackmail. The really serious part of this is that maybe a certain government employee is strong enough to withstand threats against himself. But
blackmailing type situation.
Right, right. We're going to tell the world about what happened with you back in 1998. Do you want that to happen? And maybe he's strong enough to withstand that. But they can also come at him and say, we've got this information about your daughter. We will release this to the world. We'll, you know, it's going to really ruin her life if we disclose this compromising information about her background. And so it just gives these hackers, which all implications point to the Chinese government, it gives them a great deal of power over some of the most powerful people in the United States.
And the U.S. federal government is still insisting that, well, we don't know who really did this.
Officially, that is the stance. But there are plenty of statements from experts who are a little less concerned about being politically correct, and they say the evidence incriminating Beijing is pretty strong here.
Anyone have any thoughts on this story?
Well, I would just say that these days there's a lot of talk in light of America's immigration crisis about the need to build a great wall to separate the United States from Mexico. But from this hacking scandal and others that have come out in recent years, it looks like what we need just as much, if not more, is a great firewall to protect our sensitive data and secrets that are stored in computers. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has said that America's cyber dependence is our Achilles heel. He singled it out as possibly our most vulnerable point. And this story, I believe, proves that that is absolutely true.
I think it's also interesting that meanwhile, 14 million people have had their data stolen. We still have government agencies like the NSA and others saying that it's imperative for them to collect and store information on millions of Americans. Well, now we have to ask ourselves, are we just collecting information to give to the Chinese? Is this actually benefiting us or helping our enemies?
To me, even the broader question of government competence, people put so much faith in this government to take care of every problem, every conceivable problem. They're going to solve poverty. They're going to bail out these companies that are too big to fail. They're going to, you know, like they can, there's no problem that's too big for them to say, we have the solution to it. And here's a situation where people have invested their trust that their data would be safe. And they've proven that they are absolutely unable to secure that data. And how many other areas have we seen government incompetence costing a tremendous amount, you know, to people in the nation and the nation as a whole? And yet who calls them out on that? And at what point do people say, you know what, maybe centralization, the way that they're talking about, or maybe giving them more and more power, this isn't such a good idea. These people can't really handle this in the right way.
It makes me wonder how seriously they take cybersecurity in general. I mean, it's a completely different area, but America has a huge number of drones flying by remote control. I believe their cruise missile destroyers can be controlled remotely. If they're not securing that sensitive data, how much effort have they been putting in to securing those other parts of the military? And it took didn't it take a long time for it to come out that this hack had even taken place? So have the other areas been compromised and we just don't know?
Excellent questions. We're going to look finally at America. Robert Morley, give us the important news that happened this week.
Well, talking about cybersecurity, Russia and China have cracked the top secret cache of files stolen by Edward Snowden, whistleblower Edward Snowden. MI6, the British spy agency, apparently has been pulling agents out of live operations in various countries around the world. They've even had to supposedly initiate rescue operations. And I guess Moscow, according to reports, according to the Sunday Times, has gained access to more than a million classified files that Snowden took with him when he fled to Russia. So now Russia and China, MI6 is worried, has the information. In other news, there's a massive toxic algae bloom on the Pacific Ocean. It stretches all the way from California to Washington State. Officials are saying this might be the largest ever detected off of the coast of the United States. They're saying that levels of this toxic acid that these algae produce in Monterey Bay are the highest they've ever observed. And people are dying from it. People have died from it already. Over 100 people have been sickened over it. And the other big concern is that it's starting to impact, you know, the shell food market, the fish market, and the toll that it's starting to take on marine life.
Do they know the cause?
Some scientists have said that it's related to agricultural chemicals, but they're off the west coast of the Pacific Ocean. It doesn't have massive drainage basins like it does in where there's been other Gulf, where there's been algae blooms like in the Gulf of Mexico. That's related to the Mississippi River drainage basin that overlays the agriculture region. It's not so defined. This is a huge area off of the coast of California, so scientists still trying to figure out what's going on there. And then the last item, which I think was very interesting, is that for the first time, China has been approved to join the London Bullion Market Association. This is that leading clearinghouse, that network of global banks that fix the price of gold every day. They set the price of gold. They've been doing this for more than 100 years. This has been primarily a British and American institution, primarily Britain in the past, America today. A lot of people are looking at this and hoping that China is going to stop what analysts think is a suppression of gold prices. I think they're mistaken because China is still accumulating gold and they probably want a low gold price as well.
So all of these stories are in our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Robert, the big story that you saw this week wasn't from America. What was it?
Right. It's coming from Europe, too. Gazprom just signed a deal with three European companies to double the capacity of the Nord Stream gas pipeline. If you recall, this is that pipeline that delivers Russian gas directly to Germany. It flows through the Baltic Sea, so it's not transversing any European countries. It takes that gas to Germany. From there, it gets dispersed. And if this new expansion gets approved and goes through, it has the potential, I think, to radically change the geopolitical power structure in Europe. I think there's huge implications from this deal. Just as some background, you need to remember that Europe is becoming increasingly dependent on gas from Russia. Both the United Kingdom and Norway's North Sea oil fields are in rapid decline. Production is falling off a cliff down at double-digit rates. And there doesn't appear to be any end in sight. And fracking hasn't taken off in Europe. The geology doesn't seem to work there. So they are becoming more dependent on Russia as time goes by for their gas supplies. And when this first phase of the Nord Stream was completed a few years ago, we wrote about this, talking about how Russia could use this as a geopolitical weapon. And how once that pipeline was complete, Russia would be able to turn off the gas to nations like Ukraine and Poland and be able to keep supplying it to Germany and then Western Europe. So they'd be able to coerce these Eastern European nations without angering and upsetting the West. And this is going to give them even greater power, make it more precise tool, because as analysts say, if this goes through, there's absolutely no need for Ukraine anymore, no need for Poland as these transit nations. If Russia's other pipeline that's in the construction phase or about to start construction that comes from Turkey goes through, there won't be a single Eastern European nation that Russia needs to get gas to countries like Germany, France, Spain, Portugal, United Kingdom, Netherlands. The Western advanced nations, the powerful military nations, they can still get gas from Russia, and Russia can cut off supplies to the East. Use it as a tool, geopolitical tool, to maintain their influence in Eastern Europe.
Makes Eastern European nations much more vulnerable to Russian aggression.
And they're very, very worried about this. we can expect to see a lot of pushback from nations like Poland because they have that history. They know that Russia isn't afraid of freezing them out in the winter. And Russia has done this multiple times.
Yeah, it's happened even in recent years. Yeah.
Right.
Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories that we're talking about are in there. We're going to finish up the program when we come back with our lightning round of important news from all of our panelists. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. We have so much news to report. We want to squeeze as much as we can into this program. We're going to start with Richard.
Yes, German tanks roll back into Poland. That's the headline from the Sunday Times that we've got in our Trumpet Weekly. NATO have been holding exercises within Poland, and this article just brings out now how German tanks and tanks from other countries are being welcomed back into Poland. The article also brings out, though, how these forces are not able to react as quickly as Russia. So Europe's trying to practice doing high readiness drills in Poland, but they're still not up to Russia's standard.
All right, very good. We will turn now to Brent. You gave us a few stories at the beginning. What else do you think is important this week?
There was a report in Arut Sheva, that's an Israeli paper, and it talked about a Knesset poll published on Thursday that showed that almost half of Israeli citizens, they agree with Michael Oren. He's a member of the Knesset, in that he states, Michael Oren does, that President Barack Obama has deliberately caused a deterioration in U.S. and Israeli relations. So half of Israel actually believes that that is the case, that the president of the United States is doing all this on purpose. It's not just something subsidiary to his other goals. No, he wants to deteriorate the relations with the United States and Israel. Now, Michael Oren, he's right now a member of the Knesset, but he's the former Israeli ambassador to the United States from 2009 through 2013. And he's coming out with a book next week that writers and journalists have got a copy of already. And a flood of stories came out about how revealing this book is about President Obama's agenda with Iran, but also on the opposite side of that, to just reduce the historic relationship between Israel and the United States. Now, he is not a crazy right winger. This man is a centrist. He doesn't belong to Prime Minister Netanyahu's government. He's from the Kalanu party. So for him to come out and document so clearly how the historical relationship between the U.S. and Israel has been on purpose destroyed is something to sit up and take note of. He talks about a number of instances where this has taken place. He talked about how the White House had jettisoned two core principles of the alliance. The two principles was, hey, there's going to be no surprises for you guys. We are going to alert you if we're going to give a speech about Israel that concerns Israel. We'll let you know ahead of time. That was something that all U.S. presidents had done beforehand, and that all U.S. presidents have said there would be no daylight between the two countries. And President Obama came out and said, we want daylight because that helps us see more clearly our relationship, and it helps us encourage one another and promote change. So he has obliterated those two long-standing policies, and Mr. Oren's book is going to be quite the revelation when it finally comes out, and we look forward to reading it.
Jeremiah, another big story out of Asia this week.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization said that it will assimilate India and Pakistan at its upcoming meeting in July. The SCO is a Eurasian political, economic, and military bloc. It's dominated by Russia and China, and ever since its establishment in 2001, it has very tightly only included those two countries, and then Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. So the admission of India and Pakistan will greatly extend this bloc's geographic reach, and it will also boost its collective population up to 3 billion people, give or take. So that's getting close to half of the world's population. So this really represents a huge boon to Moscow and Beijing. And it also represents sort of a black eye for Washington, because we are losing a lot of influence that we had in India with India's assimilation into this group. So it's a very significant bit of news there that India and Pakistan will be joining it.
Robert, another big story that you noticed this week.
Well, the Earth's water aquifers are depleting rapidly. The Water Resource Research Journal on Tuesday came out with a report, and they looked at 37 of the Earth's biggest aquifers between 2003 and 2013. And basically, they're saying that many of these aquifers are in trouble. They're depleting rapidly. And this is something that has even implications for the United States, as they noticed. Some of the world's biggest aquifers are in the United States. Most important productive water aquifers are in the United States. And with what's going on in California, I think for the first time since the 1930s, water issues are becoming important to America. And not just America, the world. People talk about oil being the most important commodity, but I think at a fundamental level, even surpassing that, is water and availability of it and access to it. And the Water Resource Research Journal was saying that many of these aquifers are collapsing. Some are being sucked dry with almost zero natural replenishment to offset its usage. And some of them are extremely or very highly stressed. And in California, in particular, the Central Valley Aquifer is labeled as highly stressed. And that's that aquifer that provides for so much of California's produce in terms of vegetables and almonds and things that we eat every day at our table is in trouble.
Where else in the world are these aquifers affecting?
Well, in some of the most volatile places in the world, Middle East, Saudi Arabia, for example, they have an aquifer that they've relied on for most of their agriculture, and it's going dry. It's being sucked down, and that has implications in terms of food imports and exports and national vulnerabilities. And when you start overlaying those factors together, you have the potential of turning areas like the Middle East that are already very, very volatile into something that's even more explosive.
The story that I wanted to talk about to conclude, President Obama is now saying that one of his top priorities during his remaining time in office is to deal with race and law enforcement. And specifically, what he wants to do is to federalize local police forces. There's an article in the Trumpet Weekly from Katie Pavlich in The Hill from June 15th. And she says this: Attorney General Loretta Lynch will be his go-to on this project, just as Eric Holder was before her. The goal, according to the White House and Department of Justice, is to take a close look at police practices across the country to ensure minorities, in particular African Americans, aren't unfairly singled out for police scrutiny. Now, just yesterday, we finished up the August issue of the Trumpet magazine, and the cover story was written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry. It's called Police Under Attack. It's an excellent article. It's a very strong article talking about this exact trend. I'm going to be talking about this on the show next Wednesday. But this is such an explosive topic in America today. We've been talking about what's been happening this last week for nearly an hour, and we haven't even mentioned this huge story from America this week where a white man in Charleston murdered 9 black Americans in a deliberate effort to start a race war. He actually said that explicitly, that he was trying to start a race war, and that is sick, it's depraved, it's rightly condemned all over the media. But the truth is that there are a lot of people who are agitating for a race war today. It's not just deranged white supremacist idiots. There are a lot of factors that are adding to this very serious problem, and it is going to blow up, and it's going to be a whole lot bigger than most people realize. But this article by Katie Pavlich and by Mr. Flurry's article in this Trumpet, this coming Trumpet, show that the president's efforts to solve this problem, they're not going to solve anything. They're actually going to make it far worse. When you have the federal government taking over local law enforcement, when they start hunting around for racism and they start enforcing their ideas of racial justice, everyone in this country, black, white, everybody else, is going to pay a high price for that. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Again, go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Everything that we've been talking about during this hour is in this report. There's also links to other Trumpet articles with more explanation about some of the trends that we're talking about. Send us your thoughts, send us your questions. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley, also Anthony Chabadewe. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'm going to leave you with the words of Henry Ford. He said, "Failure is the opportunity to begin again more intelligently." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.